Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 69 of the show where we talk about aviation. I'm Max Flight. Co-host Dan Webb is away again doing schoolwork, but David Vanderhoof, the Airplane Geeks historian, is here for the whole show. Hello, David.
Good evening, guys.
Rob Mark also joins us. Rob, I believe you're at the NBAA convention, right?
I am, as a matter of fact. And of course, as always, we miss Dan. But you know what? You got to do your homework. If you did your homework, you know, you'd be here with us. But that's okay. Yes, I am at NBAA. It's really cold down here in Florida. We managed to catch up with a couple of our old guests. John Ostrower is down here from Flight Global, and Benay Wilson from Avweek is here. And so we're all having a good old time, except right now, of course, because I'm in the studio recording the show.
Well, we can't wait. We're going to have a sort of a wrap-up podcast next week.
Wrap-up? We just started.
Well, by this time next week, it'll be done.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right.
All right. Well, listen, we don't have a guest this week, unfortunately.
What?
Yeah, I know.
Why not?
Did they blow us off?
Who was supposed to be the guest?
Well, we were going to do something with the Plane Crazy Down Under folks, but...
They were drinking that beer again.
Wait a minute. Did it have anything to do with those we made them promos on top of it, where we took our own time and our own energy to try to help them promote the show that they've obviously been, you know, successful at on our backs.
And they blow
us
off.
And then they leave us flat. You guys? Oh, man. We will not forget this.
No, but meantime, it'll be the three of us. We'll soldier on.
That's right.
We'll put this thing together.
And you know what? We'll have fun without those guys.
That's right.
All right. So there.
Okay. Well, we have some aviation news. We also have this week's report from the Airplane Geeks Australia desk. And, of course, David is going to have his This Week in Aviation segment. Also, Court returns with another great Whiskey Tango Foxtrot segment. That's going to be good. You'll have to listen to that. And we also have some calls from our new listener line. They're going to be fairly entertaining. Yes, we did get some calls.
Wow, hot dog.
And then we've got some other good things planned, too. So what do you say we get started with the news?
Hey.
Let's rock.
First up, this is from Flight Global. Pilot safety bill passes U.S. House. The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill meant to force the FAA and airlines to rapidly boost regional airline safety through enhanced training and hiring requirements, fatigue countermeasures, and other interventions following the deadly Colgan Air Bombardier Q400 crash in February. This bill really brings to the forefront quite a number of significant changes, it seems, or at least a number of changes. Rob, I guess that this is going to require airline pilots to hold the FAA airline transport pilot license, which has a minimum of 1,500 hours as opposed to the commercial pilot license ticket, which they can get with only 250 hours.
Well, that's true, but I think we need to back up just a tad here. I can't believe I'm actually agreeing with an FAA administrator, but this is just counter to my nature, actually. But it's okay. But you know, seriously, I mean, it passed the House, but it hasn't gotten through the Senate yet. And okay. Let's be serious. These days, it seems like the Senate is the place where any kind of legislation goes to die. And so I think I will feel a little differently about this when it gets past the Senate, but if it should, it not only is it going to change the requirements for airlines, which could indeed produce one heck of a pilot shortage, but it is going to change the flight school world. It's going to turn it upside down, because you have places in Florida, I mean, you know, Flight Safety and some of the other schools, the Delta School, Delta Connection School, and a few more that are producing pilots that have a commercial certificate and a couple 300 hours, and you know, they're putting them in the right seat of regional jets. That's all going to end now. I mean, so there's going to be some significant economic pressure, I would think, on the Senate to not allow this bill to go anywhere. But that's just my thought.
Now, the FAA administrator, who, of course, is Randy Babbitt, he said that he thinks this legislation isn't really necessary.
Well, you know, see, that years ago, in fact, when Randy Babbitt was president of the Airline Pilots Association, he was the one that was behind something, a phrase some listeners may have heard of, which was the one level of safety. And that's when what were then called commuter carriers became Part 121 carriers. They're regionals now, they call them. But, I mean, they operated under a different set of regulations, Part 135, kind of, you know, an offshoot of the same set of regulations that charter operators came from. And they said, you know, we've got to get out from under this because airline passengers deserve a single level of safety. And so the law really is on the books. It's not quite as stringent as this version we're seeing here. But unfortunately, the major carriers kind of didn't all put it together the same way. And so it was really the implementation of it that I think really caused some of the problem. And so, again, is a new law going to change that? It's going to change some of it, but I'm not sure it's the solution.
Well, I thought it was kind of interesting that there are some supporters, at least as described in this article. It says that the Regional Airline Association looks forward to this. It says also that the Airline Pilots Association says that the industry will be safer because of this bill. Do you think these groups are really solidly behind this, or are they, you know, kind of reading the tea leaves and saying, well, we better get behind it because if we oppose it, we're going to look bad?
I think ALPA is probably solidly behind it. I really do. There's probably nothing in it for them not to be behind safety. But as far as the Regional Airline Association, I don't believe anybody that says that they are solidly behind this. Again, from a customer standpoint, they cannot possibly take a tact that does not make it look like they're behind it, because who wants to fly on an airline that has a trade association that says, no, we don't really care about increasing safety standards?
Sure. That's
but economically, oh my God, this is going to be a nightmare for these people. It really is. And where they're going to come up with enough people to fly. Right now, it may not be as big a deal because, you know, again, air traffic is cut back somewhat. But when we pull out of this recession and the economy starts to take off again, it's going to be a severe pilot issue, a training issue. It really will be.
Hmm. All right. Well, I guess we'll have to watch and see if cooler heads prevail in the Senate or something else.
Yeah, we'll talk about this again when it comes out of the Senate.
Sounds great. Next story comes from Business Week. This is passenger rights advocate sues Delta, alleges email hacking. I mean, this is kind of an amazing story. This is the story about Kate Haney, who forms an organization advocating a passenger bill of rights. This came about because of an experience that apparently she had being stuck on an airplane sometime in the past. So she's accusing Delta Airlines of hacking into her email and into her personal computer, and she's seeking $11 million damage in this suit. Now, interestingly enough, apparently both AOL, America Online, and Microsoft support folks who looked into this agree that, yes, someone has hacked into her email account and they are being diverted to some unknown destination. Now, she's saying Delta's doing it. Delta, of course, is denying that they're involved in this at all. And personally, I mean, I would be shocked if it turns out in the end that Delta Airlines is actually hacking into this woman's email account.
Well, Max, actually, it wasn't Delta. It was the third party. I'm trying to find where it was.
There's Metron.
The third party consultant who was the one that was actually doing the hacking, I believe is what the way the articles were reading. Because they have a person who's filing for wrongful termination because he handed over information to her to support the organization from their metric standards.
Yeah, maybe this is a rogue subcontractor to Delta, if you will. That's maybe they've taken their job a little bit too too seriously, but if they're behind it too, this is not an appropriate situation.
No, I you know what? I find it very difficult to believe that Kate, in fact, she pronounces her name Hanai. Actually, okay. I learned that when I interviewed her a couple of years ago because I mispronounced it too. So she may not agree with us, but at least we pronounced her name right. But I find it near impossible to believe that anybody at Delta Airlines would care enough to want to get information from her account that they would sanction some hacker going after her email because of just this issue. If this ever came out and it was proven to be true, this would be like Watergate. I mean,
be terrible.
It would just be awful.
And
what is it that you could get from her email that, I mean, what strategy would you get? Now, honestly, I mean, and I've said that before here, I mean, she runs a heck of an organization. I mean, she really does. I mean, she's managed to stir up the passenger rights bill issue over the past few years in a way that no one else has. Like the pilot training, I really don't agree that the legislation is the solution, but I absolutely applaud how she has organized her people. And while I think the airlines might like to know some of what's going on, I don't believe Delta would stoop to this. I really don't.
No, I don't either. That organization of hers, I'm sure as you know, Rob, is Flyers Rights. And if you're interested in learning more about that, you can find that at flyersrights.com. Now that wasn't.
I think it's .org.
Oh, is it .org?
I think it's .org. Yeah.
Well, let's see. This says .com.
Oh, really? I stand correct. I thought it was flyersrights.org.
Let's just try opening it up, and we'll see what comes up.
It might be one of those that maybe it's...
Both?
Both, yeah. I was just going to say
both.
It's both.
It's
okay.
Both. Okay, the page that comes up it has the title flyersrights.org, but .com redirects to that. So,
my biggest question on this whole article was, who uses their AOL account to communicate with their legal staff and lawyers?
Well, that's a good question.
I when I read that, I
beside my wife.
Just okay. It was sort of like, okay, I would not call an AOL account the most secure place to store important personal information. I have one, but I don't think I would actually send legal documents between my lawyer and. Doesn't the lawyer know better? I guess it's a rhetorical question of all.
Yeah, no, good question. I mean, normally you want to send legal documents through an encrypted channel or by some other means to protect it, because otherwise it's just out there in the clear. Now, this wasn't the only example or the only case of hacking that we encountered in this past week. We have a report from theregister.co.uk, Michigan Airport Grounds website over malware risk. The Gerald R. Ford International Airport, which is in Grand Rapids, they had to pull their site in response to some kind of an unspecified malware threat. They had to temporarily suspend their site. It also infected the airport's admin system. And so for some period of time, they had to shut this down, and their customers, the flyers, did not have access to their site. Which this is a very interesting story. If we have airports with vulnerabilities of this sort, you know, anybody can hack in, and that's kind of scary.
Imagine people having to learn about their airlines the old-fashioned way by picking up the telephone.
Yeah, maybe they don't remember how.
So I know, but you're right. It's a terrible thing. Nobody wants to have their website hacked. I had my Twitter account hacked a month or so ago, and it was a real pain in the butt. But it is interesting that the page, if the one that was in the news story was correct, I guess it was somebody trying to send you to a Microsoft-related site, I think. Was that right?
It was mostly a blank page without much description of what was going on.
Well, but they got it back, right? So, I mean...
They got it back.
What's the big deal? I mean, and besides, let's be serious, it's the Gerald R. Ford International Airport.
There we go.
I mean,
the jokes will start now.
Yeah, I mean... No, I am not... I have listen, you guys should know right now, I've turned over a new leaf.
You have.
No more lame jokes. No more lame jokes at other people's expense.
None?
Well, very few.
Very few.
Very, very
okay.
few. Okay. And really, I mean, I'm not gonna fall down, you know, worrying about Gerald Ford and, you know, any of that kind of stuff. So never mind. Okay.
All right. There was an awful lot of UAV news online this week. The next article comes from Aviation Week. This is UK military wants ISTAR UAV in 2015. It seems that the British Defense Ministry is trying to push forward the acquisition process, looking to get on the books some armed, long-endurance, unmanned aerial vehicles for the first quarter of 2010. Apparently, there is a defense review coming up, and they'd like to get their orders on the books before that review.
I wonder what the delivery time on
the delivery time on a UAV.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of these are still under development. The article mentions this Mantis technology demonstrator program. This is from BAE Systems. And in this case, the aircraft is under development, and I think earlier this year had an initial flight, if I remember correctly. But it's still just in the development stage. So, I mean, this doesn't sound like something that's that close at hand.
Actually, Max, it's really not. Great Britain actually did an emergency purchase of Predator UAV, Predator Bs, right. The advanced Predators. As a stopgap to get a home indigenous homegrown UAV. The Mantis, I think, is equivalent to a Predator B with a longer range. Where the UAVs have taken a different chain in a lot of these articles this week have discussed it, is we've gone from a purely observation or reconnaissance aircraft to reconnaissance and attack. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole new spectrum on these. This ISTAR being intelligence, surveillance, target acquisition, and reconnaissance platform. So it's not only finding the bad guys, it's finding the bad guys, then blowing up the bad guys.
Right, right.
So a lot of these UAVs are being delayed because they want to get the attack aspects loaded into the program.
We do see that the U.S. Air Force seems to be taking a strong approach in the UAV arena. There was an interesting article. This was from strategypage.com called Flight Pay for Non-Flyers. And in this article, it points out that the Air Force, the U.S. Air Force, has created a career field for UAV operators. And that will eventually include operators who are not now pilots. Also that the Air Force has decided to give these non-pilot UAV operators flight pay, which is very, very interesting. And presumably this is, as the article states, is that the reason for this is to create an economic incentive to get qualified candidates to staff these new kinds of UAV operator positions. Historically, I guess the Air Force only uses pilots as UAV operators, and not only that, but has the same requirements for these folks.
Well, they're officers to start with. I mean, they're officer pilots. They're
officer pilots.
Officers.
And they have the same medical requirements and so forth as pilots who fly aircraft. Even though a UAV operator is just sitting in a darkened room in some in some basement someplace.
Well, if they are indeed officer pilots, that makes sense. But I mean, the part about non-flying, non-licensed pilots flying these things and being forced to put up with the need to have a medical, I don't know. But I guess if you're the Air Force and you have more people than you need, you can do anything you want.
Part of the medical is reaction time, etc. I would assume that even in a flying a drone or a UAV, you still need that kind of skill set to be a efficient Predator pilot as you would an F-16 pilot. Maybe you disagree, Rob.
Listen, I'm a great Predator. Let me tell you guys, I'm a scary dude. All right, maybe. No, seriously, the medical, at least now, of course, the Air Force medical for pilots that they go through on an annual or semi-annual basis may be completely different than what we're used to here in on the civilian side. And maybe it is looking for those kinds of traits. But I mean, a civilian medical does not really, even a first class doesn't test for that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So, again, I don't know, but I think this is tradition, is that in the Air Force, the only people that ever flew airplanes were officers, which is one of the reasons that when I joined the Air Force, I couldn't fly, even though I had because I didn't have a degree at the time, and I couldn't be an officer. And they just said, that's it, kid. And some of this is left over from that, I think. But also what I read in that story, I think is probably true, that some of the people flying these drones are saying, wow, you know, it's not even exactly like flying. I mean, it's like playing flight sim. I mean, it really is. So how stringent do they have to be? Especially when the thing's on autopilot most of the time. So again, I think this is an evolving thing for the Air Force, and they're being a little slow.
Yeah, and that makes sense to me too. You know, the article points out that all the other military services will use non-pilot, non-commissioned officers to fly UAVs. That they've done this for a while, and the Air Force has been sort of the sole holdout. But if the military aviation swings away from manned aircraft and more towards unmanned aircraft, the demand for these kind of pilots or controllers, if you will, is going to go up. And I'm sure that there's a lot of overlap in the skill set, but I'm not entirely convinced it's an identical skill set. And I think applying the, you know, sort of the conventional pilot rules to this new generation of UAV pilot, you know, may not survive long term.
No, I don't think it will either. But I don't know. What do you think, David?
I don't know. It's a whole... one of the things that when I was reading all about these UAVs was there's a new television show called NCIS Los Angeles.
Right.
And 2 weeks ago, they actually had an episode where a Predator was hacked by someone else, by a foreign entity, and was going to go attack Los Angeles. So we've got the hacking in the UAVs. But the main pilot character was extremely exasperated about how his life has turned out, that he was planning on going through officer school and planned on going to school to fly F-16s, and now he's flying a Predator in a box somewhere, and how he's completely unhappy and miserable, and how the Air Force has taken his whole dreams and livelihoods away from him because now he's flying not what he wanted to be flying in the first place. So I have a feeling that there's a lot of that going around. And if the Air Force, if you let enlisted do it, they might look at it as a step up, whereas the officers will look at it as a downgrade. You know, I mean, if you're going from F-16s to Predators, I don't know how you handle that.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And, you know, bringing people in who are, you know, enjoy flying UAVs, I think it's got to end up being a different process than that brings pilots in to fly F-16s. I think, you know, like I was talking about the skill sets being different, I think the personality types is probably somewhat different too, but hey, I'm just speculating.
Yeah, and again, some of it is just tradition. I mean, and some of it's just change. I mean, they don't want to change that. Of course, just to be fair, I mean, 24 had an episode 2 years ago where a Predator got away from, some civilian or the good guys, got into the hands of the bad guys, and they were going to drop it on San Francisco, aim it at San Francisco. And luckily, of course, Jack Bauer managed to pull it out.
Save the day.
Save the day.
Well, we ran across an interesting article in Defense Professionals. This was called China's Leap in Unmanned Aircraft Development. That's a rather long and comprehensive article, but if our listeners are interested in, you know, getting a more complete picture about UAVs from a worldwide basis, this might be a good article to look at. In that article, the senior unmanned systems analyst for Forecast International, that's Larry Dickerson, he stated that the international demand for UAVs is really growing rapidly, and that while the U.S. accounts for over 60% of the UAV market that some other companies are kind of keeping up and some others are not. He mentioned that some of the Western European countries and Israel are keeping up with UAV development, but other countries like China and Russia are much farther behind in this regard, that a lot of the development that they've been doing with UAVs comes about by copying U.S. and other UAV technology, and that, you know, purely indigenously developed UAV projects are less frequent. But China has recently shown signs that they are extremely interested in becoming a player in this field. And the example they gave was at the recent 60th anniversary celebration of the People's Republic of China, that there were 10 short and mid-range tactical reconnaissance UAVs that took part in the parade. That's a big number.
I think it goes without saying that in a not so recent episode of 24, the bad guys were the Chinese, and they were trying to do bad things here in the United States by stealing technologies. And I think this story proves out that, again, Jack Bauer was on the right track.
He's getting a lot of press tonight.
Yeah. Well, you know, listen, honestly, I'm only doing this because I'm hoping the Fox people are listening, because my wife really wants to meet Jack Bauer. So, you know, or I mean,
Kiefer
Sutherland, right? Yeah. So, and you know, I'd like to do this for her birthday, but, you know, that's okay. So, Jack, listen, if you're listening, you know where to find us here, Airplane Geeks.
Now you can tell her you tried.
I did try, yeah. Okay. But seriously, Matt, though, I think it's not surprising, though, that the and I didn't mean to interrupt you there, David. But hey, long as I did. No, but I mean, really, look at what they're up to. I mean, they're headed into the civil aviation market, both large and small airplanes, and I don't think there's any doubt that the Chinese are going to have some version of this somehow in the near future.
Of interesting note in this article, Max, is a indirect connection between Israel and China.
Hmm.
Historically, Israel has always been, believe it or not, the ahead of the curve on UAVs above everybody else. We sort of learned the technology from them. In the original Gulf War, the UAVs we were using were actually Israeli aircraft industry designed aircraft. But one of the things that China actually has a new aircraft called the J-10, which is a fourth generation supersonic jet fighter, which is their equivalent to an F-15 or an F-16.
Mm-hmm.
That technology actually came from Israel. That aircraft is wholly based on the Israeli aircraft Lavi, which was in the 70s, which Lockheed Martin successfully got canceled because it was a better aircraft than the F-16, and they just didn't want it out in the market.
Too much of a threat.
Right. So China is really good at getting people to give them over samples, and we're back to the old historical thing where how did the Russian Air Force get the Tu-4 Bull? What they did was they had 3 B-29s, and they bit by bit completely rebuilt them.
Yes, right.
So this article really draws the line that most of their technology is they're re-engineering a lot of Western and European and Israeli technology, but they're putting their own spin on it, and they're catching up a lot quicker than we probably give them credit for.
Hmm. Well, linking UAV technology to another topic we've talked about a lot, which is alternatives to traditional aviation gas. We have an interesting article from Science Daily called Ion Tiger Fuel Cell Unmanned Air Vehicle Completes 23-Hour Flight. Now, we've talked about biofuel and, you know, some other things in the past, but another potential source of energy for flight is a fuel cell, which, of course, takes hydrogen and oxygen, uses that to create electricity, with water being really the only byproduct. So this hydrogen-powered fuel cell vehicle is apparently set an endurance flight record for a fuel cell powered flight. That was earlier this month at Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland. And this was a small aircraft. I mean, it's only 37 pounds. It only carries a 4 or 5 pound payload. The fuel cell is a 550 watt fuel cell, which is roughly equivalent to 3/4 of a horsepower. So this is a very small device, yet it does show that there's potentially another alternative source of energy for, you know, for aircraft.
So then if it produces electricity, then I'm assuming it's electric motor that's powering this UAV then, right?
That's right. So it's a small electric powered but driven by the fuel cell vehicle.
And the article does say that it's extremely quiet, and it has even less of a radar cross-section because all it's generating is basically water vapor out the back of it. So from a tactical standpoint, it sounds like it's a great step forward if you want a stealthy UAV.
Right, exactly. You know, we're probably a long ways away from seeing this in any kind of a truly commercial context, but maybe not.
Well, I don't know. I mean, up at Oshkosh this year at Air Venture, they had a couple of
electric
aircraft prototypes, light sport aircraft with electric prototypes. And of course, while they admitted they didn't have all the bugs worked out of them yet, I think the most interesting thing about all of this is that people are looking at methods of propelling airborne vehicles now in ways that we would have laughed at even 5 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that research is probably the most exciting part of this, I think.
Well, we've also seen just recently a commercial passenger jet powered by natural gas, or powered by a fuel made from natural gas, I should be. This is reported by Reuters. The article is Airline Flies First Passenger Flight on Natural Gas. And this was a six-hour flight, London to Qatar, on an Airbus A340-800. And one of the Rolls-Royce Trent 556 engines used a 50-50 blend of synthetic gas on this Qatar Airways flight.
First of all, I have to admit, I did not know about this. I'm until I saw this story. And I guess what surprises me more than even the fact that I didn't know about it was the fact that nobody's talking about this. I think the way this came down, this is absolutely amazing. I am a little surprised that this happened on a revenue-generating flight, and no one knew that this thing was going to happen. So they must have been doing an awful lot of research on it to be to a point where they could run, flight on this.
But they only did use one engine. I missed that. The first read through was that it sounds like only one engine had access to the fuel, so it wasn't a completely flown flight on the natural gas.
Oh no, I understand that, but I mean, you have also have to understand that you have passengers on board. You don't turn them into guinea pigs. I mean, which is essentially what you're doing. And to say that, well, don't worry, if this engine fails, we have three more. It doesn't work like that on a big airplane at high altitude. I mean, you open the door for all kinds of problems,
liability issues if something happens.
Yeah, I guess I'm just a little surprised that this went down. But of course, it's not a U.S. registered airplane or even one out of the EU, and maybe they can get away with a little more over there. It is still an amazing feat, though, that they ran it partially on natural gas.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if anybody was on that flight, please let us know what it was like.
Yeah.
Going to airplanegeeks.com. Give us a call. That number is?
You mean the Airplane Geeks number? Sure. 361-433-5701.
That's right.
Is that right?
That's right, which is also 361-GEEKS-01.
Whoa. Oh, I'm sorry. Hey, and you know what? Maybe he has it better. So, David, why don't you say it? Maybe yours will sound better than mine did. I didn't like the way I said it anyway. Gee, what's that number for Airplane Geeks?
It's 361-GEEKS-01. 361-GEEKS-01.
Very good.
Whoa. Pretty cool.
And now David, the official Airplane Geeks historian, has This Week in Aviation.
Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 1, Episode 18, October 18th through October 24th. On October 18th, 1983, Pan American Airlines and American Airlines announced that they will trade aircraft. Pan Am will send 15 McDonnell Douglas DC-1010s and DC-1030s to American in exchange for 8 Boeing 747-100s. The Pan Am DC-10s were from the acquisition of National Airlines in 1980. The American Airlines 747-100s were purchased in 1966 with the hopes that domestic air travel would continue to grow exponentially as it had done in the early 60s. That did not materialize. Ironically, American had been the launch customer for the DC-10 and Pan American had been the launch customer for the 747. This is the first time in history the two airlines agreed to a swap. And as far as I can tell, it was also the last time that two airlines agreed to a swap in aircraft.
Yeah, very interesting.
October 20th, 1953. Transworld Airlines, TWA, Lockheed L-1049 Super G Constellations, makes the first nonstop scheduled passenger flight across the United States. The flight was from LaGuardia to LAX, Los Angeles. Almost 50 years later to the day, on October 24th, 2003, British Airways Concorde G Boeg, flown by Mike Bannister, makes the last flight from New York JFK to Heathrow, London. During that flight, British Airways launched two additional Concorde excursion flights, GBOAE to Edinburgh, Scotland, and GBOAF over the Bay of Biscay. All three arrived back at Heathrow within minutes of each other, with GBOAG landing last at 4.05 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, thus officially ending the career of the Concorde. Air France had ended service on May 30th earlier of 2003. October 24th, 1919. Frank Piasecki is born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Piasecki becomes the second man in the United States to fly a helicopter in 1943. The first was Igor Sikorsky in the VS-300.
Of course.
Piasecki's company developed many of the world's most successful tandem rotor helicopters, meaning that the rotor is in the front and the back, the H-21 Shawnee, the CH-46 Seanight, and the CH-47 Chinook. That company, Piasecki Helicopters, eventually became Vertol Helicopters, which became Boeing Vertol, which I live approximately 5 minutes away from. And last but not least, we have first flights that occurred during the week of October 18th through October 24th. The Northrop YB-49 Flying Wing Bomber first flew on October 21st, 1947, and the Bell UH-1D Iroquois, form always known as the Huey, on October 22nd, 1956. And that's the way it was, October 18th through October 24th.
Okay, great. Thank you, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Well, g'day, folks. It's Steve Vischer here, and with me is Grant McHaren. How are you, Grant?
Yeah, not too bad, mate. Not too bad, talking a little fast, because we're rather constrained for time this time.
Yes, this is a very, very time-compressed Australia desk this week. Grant, can you, what episode is this of the Airplane Geeks, anyway?
Oh, mate, I can't remember. I honestly can't remember which episode it is, but hey, why don't we ask these two likely-looking Charlies?
Yeah, they look very intelligent.
69, dudes!
Whoa, most bodacious. Thanks, dudes.
There you go.
Episode 69. That's a pretty heavy episode to get to. I dream of the day that Plane Crazy Down Under gets to 69 episodes.
Yes, well, we'll keep dreaming for now, Grant, but our first article this week is dealing with our friends at Air New Zealand again. We're talking across the Tasman again, and they've issued a rather cheeky invite to our other friends at Southwest Airlines.
G'day, Herb. I'm Nicola.
And I'm Will.
While we were filming a few extra shots for our body painted safety video,
our beloved leader thought he'd get us to send you a quick invite. We think this invite is delightfully inappropriate given our combined attitude for doing things a little differently.
Oh, those cheeky Kiwis, wherever will it end?
Oh, mate, I think it's brilliant. This is definitely in the spirit of the Plane Crazy Down Under cheeky crowd. Yes, once again, the Kiwis, in addition to doing their body paint only safety videos, have thrown out a challenge to Southwest Airlines to do an ultimate mashup and have their crew and Southwest's crew in body paint only doing a show.
Did we get a response from Southwest? So they issued it directly to Herb Keller of Southwest. Southwest. I assume he would have seen it.
Yeah, oh, definitely. Southwest have definitely tweeted it, and it's been on their Facebook page. Back on Friday evening, they threw out on their Twitter feed about how they love a little collaboration, or as they're calling it, collabotition. So they're, from their Twitter feed from the October 16th, they have a link across to the it's on YouTube. So they actually have a link to the YouTube page that you can watch it from. So, yeah, and it's on their Facebook feed with a lot of response going, yeah, let's do it. So I reckon it's great.
I tell you what, Grant, I continue to be impressed with this this new attitude of Air New Zealand. They really have turned the way they do business around, and it's really refreshing to see. I keep saying it, I know I probably sound like a broken record, but it's really refreshing to see how they're really tackling a new way of marketing their airline. It's only a very small airline in New Zealand by world standards, even smaller than Qantas.
But yeah, it's great. I think they've definitely taken a few pages out of the Richard Branson playbook. They're getting cheeky, they're getting irreverent, and they're getting into guerrilla marketing in a big way. It's great to see.
Yep, it's excellent. Okay, Grant, our next story, we're staying across the Tasman again this week. Gee, Grant, it must have been a really boring news week down here in Australia if we're having to look at New Zealand for both our stories this week.
Oh, well, it's been okay for the Aussies, but the Kiwis have definitely hit a couple of really good strides, especially ones that are pretty good at linking between down under and up on top, because both of these stories relate between New Zealand and the US.
Yeah, we've spoken before about our dismay at the 2001 decision of the New Zealand government to retire their entire strike fighter force. They had a force of A4K Skyhawks, which were pretty highly tricked up. They'd been brought up to F-16 standards with their avionics, I believe.
That's right. They had a dorsal hump fairing that was just packed full of electronics. They were known as an A4K, the K for Kiwi. There were 17 of them, and they were retired and mothballed along with another 17 Air Marchie MB339 trainers, which were the follow-on to the Mackie trainers that the RAF used to fly. They were the MB326 trainers that they flew here in Australia for a long time until the Pilatus PC9s took over. So the Kiwis got the 339, which was the second generation of that aircraft. So 17 retired A4K Skyhawks and 17 Air Marchie MB339s were in mothballs since 2001, pending sale. That had been blocked and delayed by the US State Department.
Yeah, so that's quite surprising, Grant. I actually didn't realise that those aircraft were still in New Zealand. I would have thought they would have been scrapped long, long ago, but apparently they're still sitting there somewhere in New Zealand and have been in mothballs all this time.
That's correct. They were parked in storage at Woodburn, the Woodburn Air Base. They were covered in protective latex and moved to outside storage in 2007 to make space for the C-130 life extension program. They were sitting in the hangars, but once they were fully shrink-wrapped, high-tech shrink-wrapped, put outside. So it's going to be good that looks like if this is all going ahead, it's going to be great, because they've been trying to sell them since 2005 to Tactical Air Systems in Arizona. Indications are that that is indeed who's going to actually be buying them. The reason for the delay is that the U.S. State Department was doing all the paperwork, and as well, the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms had to approve the transfer of the ejection seat initiation explosives. So, yeah, when you've got two very bureaucratic groups over there going for it, you know it's going to take a while.
Yeah, so what are we talking here, Grant? $155 million New Zealand dollars, or $128 million Australian. So a fairly good little earner there for New Zealand at shame. A shame, as we've said before, that they just don't have any strike fighter capability at all now, and they've basically been reduced to aerial reconnaissance and peacekeeping type work.
Yeah, that's right. Most of their fighter pilots left to serve in the Royal Australian Air Force and the Royal Air Force itself as well. But this deal is not done in stone as yet, because the Arizona company has to send engineering staff to New Zealand to assess the aircraft before the final deal gets reached. The company Tactical Air Systems provides training services to the US government and other allied governments while they're there. So I guess if they're Arizona-based, they may actually be used as part of red flag training or maybe things like that.
Might even turn them into target drones or something. I mean, they're pretty old airframes, let's face it.
Oh, dude, don't say that.
What a shame.
I know, I'm going to cry. I love the kitty carts. That's what we used to call them in New Zealand. We used to call them the kitty carts.
Yes, well, you New Zealanders, you all talk funny, you know. Did you know New Zealanders have really strange accents, Grant?
Rich, fucking crummy.
There you go.
Yeah, it's been a while since I spoke that accent.
People may be aghast to know that Grant is originally from New Zealand. Yeah, strange but true, folks. Anyway, we're very quick Australia disc this week, folks. We both have to rush off. I actually have to rush off and go to work and do night shifts. So, Grant, anything else to add?
No, I think that's about it.
Until next week, folks, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarron.
Cheers, guys.
Well, all right. We thank Steve and Grant, as always, for sending their Australia Desk segment.
I think it was actually kind of interesting. Essentially, they're talking about these airplanes having sat around in Trojans, large Trojans, for all these years, I guess, down there, right?
Big red.
Yeah, I guess, you know, those crazy... listen, guys, I have a confession to make. You know, we were going to have the plane crazy down under guys as our guests, and then we were really beating them up because they didn't show up. I was supposed to ask them, and I think I forgot.
Well, maybe that explains it.
Maybe we should be nice to them again.
I think that's a great idea.
After all, when they're famous, we're going to need them. Let's be serious.
Yeah, that's right.
Sorry, guys, mates.
All right. Well, Court sent in another Whiskey Tango Foxtrot segment.
Hot dog.
Yeah, this is a great one. Give us a listen.
Fasten your seatbelt by inserting the metal fitting into the buckle and adjust the strap so that it fits low and tight around your hips.
Hey guys, this is Courtney, back with a Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, finally. I know it's been a while, I've been getting settled in up here in the Great White North, but let me just say, I really have missed working with the airplane geeks, and I'm glad to be back, at least what little bit I can, in the Whiskey Tango Foxtrot segment. Max, absolutely miss working with you, and the other two guys, whatever their names are, yeah, tell them to. No, really, guys, I do miss it, and now that I have found a couple minutes, I can get another Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. So my first Whiskey Tango Foxtrot this week goes out to, congratulations, your first negative comment. This is big, and I know this happened quite a few weeks ago, but it's such big news that we can't forget about it, especially when the negative comment was that things weren't as good as when the guy who left used to be here. Of course, that guy being me. So I just like to rub that in. But no, it really is telling. When you do get negative comments, especially when you take them as constructive criticism, but Dan, Rob, Max, you guys are all doing great, as always. And I routinely, and by that I mean weekly, as the show is published, find myself being jealous because I really wish I was a part of it. So keep up the good work. Max, thanks for taking this on. As far as the actual Whiskey Tango Foxtrot story this week, I thought I'd go kind of off the edge a little bit. And it is aviation themed, I promise you. But this is a little story and a mystery about Bo. Who is Bo, you might ask? Well, of course, Bo is the Obama's dog. Well, apparently there's a rumor that the first dog left a number two on Air Force One. The reason this has become a story is because, well, the Air Force and the White House has denied it. It's a puppy. That's what puppies do. Some of the quotes from this story are absolutely hilarious. It's actually from the Wall Street Journal. It says, "You can imagine the horror on board when they discovered what it had done." According to the article, a flight attendant nearly stepped in it. Says Barack Obama about the dog. He says, "We go out and we're walking and I'm picking up poop." And in the background is a beautifully lit White House. It's quite a moment. So the big question in the Whiskey Tango Foxtrot this week goes out to Bo, the first dog. What were you thinking? Seriously, that's like the most expensive airplane in the world. And you have to soil the carpet? Well, that's it for Whiskey Tango Foxtrot this week. Keep up the good work, guys. We'll see you later. And as we always like to say, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. See ya. Ha ha ha.
No, that was good. I thought the part about the dog on the Air Force One was really well done. So, Courtney, yes, we hope you're freezing your buns off up there in Canada. But listen, you're the one that took the job.
Is it me? But why would you even bother denying it?
I know, that's so bizarre.
It's like there's some Air Force colonel in the press corps having to stand up saying it never happened. There's no unidentified flying poo aboard. It's like, just say, yeah, you want to defuse the story, just say, yes, it happened. We cleaned it up. It's taken care of. Let's move on.
Exactly. In response to our request last week, some of our listeners left voicemails on our new listener line. The first one we got came in from Stephen.
Hello, Max, Rob, and Dan. This is your friend Stephen from Southern California, works for JetBlue. Just thought I'd give you a call. Heard your latest podcast, loved it, and liked the Cranky Flyer, Brett Schneider on there, very good. And keep up the good work. Take care. Bye.
Well, obviously a very intelligent fellow, I would say.
Yeah, he knows what he's talking about. We also got this
absolutely.
One.
Hey, this is Rob Mark from JetWine.com.
Well, you said you wanted sound effects. How's that one?
Rob, that was you and Steve Fisher. Just testing the new system.
Yes, we were.
All right, we got a voicemail from Trevor Smith. He sent in a joke, Rob, since you had asked for some jokes last week.
Oh, great.
Trevor is a pilot and a student at Arizona State, and I think he's going for a BS with a major in aeronautical management technology.
Well, you definitely need a BS to do some jokes.
Yes, you do. So listen to this.
He also talks. Bump, crash.
Yeah, okay.
Trevor also talks about his blog that he has, Desert Pilot. Just listen to this.
Hey, guys. My name's Trevor. Shouting out from Arizona. I'm a student at Arizona State in their airport management program. I'm also a private pilot working on my instrument rating and commercial rating and C rating and other ratings. Stuff like that. Hey, just wanted to shout out you guys. I love the show. Love listening to it. I listen to every podcast I can. I know you guys were looking for jokes. The only joke I could think of was there was a helicopter pilot and a fixed-wing pilot flying along in a little Cessna or whatever. And the helicopter pilot was at the controls and was wondering why it was so turbulent here in the morning. And then the fixed-wing pilot leans over and says, you need to let go of the controls. And, oh, it smoothed right up. It might not be very good, but oh well. quick plug for me. I got a blog and also upcoming, trying to start a podcast too, at desertpilot.com. So you can check that out. Other than that, love you guys' show. Keep going. It's always very interesting. So I'll talk to you guys later, I guess. I guess I'm not going to talk to anyone since this isn't a message. whatever.
It's always hard to talk into a machine.
Well, first of all, I think that's great. I'm glad to hear there's another blogger and podcaster out there. But I have to be honest, if you guys think that we're going to train another generation of podcaster competitors like those guys down under, you guys are crazy. I'm not enough, doing this again.
Well, I listened to his first podcast, and it's pretty interesting. It's recording contains a lot of cockpit audio, and it's really an interesting listen. And I just noticed that today, actually, he posted a second podcast, so I encourage you all to go take a look at that. That's Desert Pilot, and that's at desertpilot.blogspot.com. And then finally,
oh, yeah, let's go here.
Yeah, it's good, and it's interesting stuff. I love cockpit recordings, especially when things are happening that are kind of interesting and things that I'm not familiar with.
Thanks for that comment, though.
Don't become better than us.
That's not too hard.
Is that the message? Is that the subtle message that we're getting here? Is that everyone else realizes they could do a way better job than us? That's kind of scary.
Isn't that always the way, though? Oh, I can do that.
Yep, I guess it's true, but
just try doing it 69 times.
Well, that gets
okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right, the last one is from Carl. He left a message requesting that we look at some of the hot new light sport aircraft coming out.
Hey there. Yeah, your Google Voice number sounds great. This is Carl from Fort Lauderdale calling. Keep up the good work and see if you can squeeze in maybe something like a critical review of some of the later hot LSA kits and whatnot that are coming out. In particular, I'm thinking about the Icon A5 and other similar genre of craft. Thanks. See ya.
And thanks to Carl for sending that in. Yeah, the LSA category is I find it fascinating stuff. And maybe that's something that we can focus in on in a future episode.
Well, you know, in fact, that just gave me a great idea. I know Dan Johnson, who is the executive director of the Light Sport Aircraft Association, and he makes, I couldn't tell you the address of his website, but he spends a fair amount of his time doing reviews of light sport aircraft. Maybe we can get him on and talk about LSAs a little bit.
Fantastic idea. That's great.
Thanks for that idea, Carl. Good job, buddy.
Absolutely.
Check's in the mail.
All right. I'd like to thank David Vanderhoof for joining us for the entire show this week and also for your This Week in Aviation segment. Thank you, David. I think we've lost David again. We'd also like to thank our friends down under, that, of course, being Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren, for their Australia Desk report, and also for the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast they put together. It's really a good listen. Encourage everyone to check that out if you haven't already. Let's see, Rob, where can people find you online?
Well, people can find me at jetwine.com or on Twitter at jetwine. And can I just make a pitch for something that's coming up in the Chicago area where we live? There's a brand new aviation-focused store, extravaganza store called Aviation World that's out near O'Hare there. I believe it's Elk Grove Village, Illinois. So for those of you that are in the Chicago area, and it has a grand opening Saturday the 25th, I believe it is, or whatever the next Saturday is. So get on out there and say hi to these folks. It's an aviation. It's a pilot.
It's a pilot shop. Okay.
All kinds of pilot gear, books, headsets, CDs, charts. You name it. And apparently, they're going to be very centrally located for people in the Chicago area, and that's a problem we have had for quite a while. So, Aviation World and their website's aviationworld.net.
Okay.
So go give them a look. Anyway, good. But we'll see you all next week. And wow, I just love this hotline. I mean, it's just, does that make you wonder, though, Max, whether, you know, now that we have control of the hotline, that maybe Courtney has been hoarding the calls?
Maybe they've been coming in all along and we just didn't know it.
Yeah, I think we need to have a little chat with that young man.
Right.
So, anyway, thank you all for listening.
Yeah, absolutely. Please take advantage of that. We'd still love to get some more calls from y'all and be happy to play them. So just give us a shout.
361-GEEKS-01.
That's also the same thing as 361-433-5701. If you, like me, hate to look at the letters and figure out which numbers they are. GEEKS-01 is easier to remember. You can, if you haven't subscribed to us, you can do that on iTunes or on the Zoom Marketplace, either one. And you can also send us email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. We love getting email as well as voice recordings.
We should say goodnight to David, though, since we lost him somewhere in the Skypeosphere.
That's right. Good night, David. thanks for joining
say
us.
Say goodnight, David.
Say goodnight. Goodnight. David.
Oh, don't you want to ask me the question? The question you always ask?
Yes, Rob. How can people help spread the word about the Airplane Geeks podcast?
Tell their friends.
Absolutely. Tell everyone you know.
Hey. You betcha. Hey, it was a nice show. Thanks again, Max. It was nice being a part of this.
Thanks to everyone.
See y'all next week.
Bye-bye. Hot as hell. Beautiful and rolling. Summertime. Summertime.
rock song from in the 60s. Oh, Pamela.
That would be the 80s in Toto.
Oh.
David comes right up with it.
God. You know, you have a mind like a steel trap. You know, you should be a like a historian or something. Yeah.
Okay. Colossal amounts of useless knowledge.
All right. I'm psyched. Wait, I've got to hydrate.
Trying to play Dan.
I'm at peace with the world.
This is going to be a good one. Hey, I hear a lot of heavy breathing. Is that coming from you, Rob?
You've got one heck of a sensitive mic.
Well, I
got
to breathe.
Let the forest
rise. This is Young Skywalker.
Oh, you guys are good.
Sorry, I didn't realize I was... I'm sorry, I didn't realize I was breathing again.
No, breathing's okay.
I'll just knock it off.
Quietly.
It's still better than clipping your nails.
Yeah. Rob comes through with more sounds. Who needs Steve Vischer when you got Rob?
Okay, that's right.
That's cool.
Who am I being? Okay.
That would be Dan.